My name is Tom Denick. I'm with the Wisconsin State Laboratory of Hygiene, and I'm going to talk to you today about HL7 transforms. I'm a nuts and bolts kind of guy. I do the programming. And so I'm sure if any of you have been involved with this, you sometimes feel like this fella here. That round hole being, of course, the fin guide. And the square peg is your laboratory information system. So what we're going to try to do is accomplish what this guy is looking to do. I just want to introduce, give you a little more background. The Wisconsin Laboratory of Hygiene is affiliated with the University of Wisconsin, which kind of puts us in a unique position among health laboratories. Typically, state health labs are associated with the State Department of Public Health. We're autonomous from the public health department. We do clinical, environmental, and industrial hygiene analytical services. Of course, training, technical assistance, and because of our UW ties, we also have research and instructional responsibilities. I'd encourage you all to visit our website if you have time, which is another thing that I'm associated with. So let's start with an overview here, and actually I have a comment on this picture because this is one I took last year. This is from the Dahlhauser Wasserfall Overlook in Tirol, Austria, and that's the Achensee, which is a nice little lake. It's a beautiful spot, and if you go there in the fall, you'll get a really good deal in a room. So I'm going to focus on V2 ORU messages, although I think most of the things I'm going to talk about can be applied to any HL7 message. V2 ORU just happens to be the majority of the kind of things that we deal with at the Lab of Hygiene. I want to explain why you need to do transforms, talk about some of the tools, strategies, techniques, and finally we'll try to put it all together. So why do we need to transform HL7? Well, every LIS is different. The schemas are different, the data structures are different, there's different resources available for actually creating your HL7 message. Some LISs may create an HL7 message for you, other ones may make you write it from scratch. There's also differences in the way your clinicians define their tests, the kind of descriptions they use for the test results, and the methods they use for performing those tests. Also, and this one I run into all the time, is where data entry is either done incorrectly or the data systems are misused. This occurs, sometimes it's just a simple mistake, a typo. More often the case is to accommodate other software or legacy systems. It's not at all uncommon for me to go to someone and say, well, why did you do that? And they go, because it looks nice in the report. Lastly, you'll run into unique requirements of your target systems. We're not always writing our HL7 for the CDC. Sometimes it's because we need to send it to another proprietary system, another legacy system that may not follow CDC's guides. So let's open up our toolbox. Right now there's a really nice selection of both proprietary and open source HL7 tools. And this is something that's just been happening in the last few years. I'll just note a parenthetically that I've only been involved with this for the last 2.5 years. Formerly, I worked in the environmental lab area of the laboratory. So this has been a real eye-opener for me. I was very excited when I found that there was a format specifically for clinical messages, and then very disappointed to find that while the specification was there, it worked for hardly anything. Choose your tools based on your needs. You may have some cultural within your shop, like You may find that management wants everything written in a specific language. And then there's also comfort levels issues. Whatever tool you pick, get familiar with it. You need to be comfortable with whatever devices you're going to use to modify your HL7. And if you pick a tool and it doesn't work for you, throw it away. Don't waste your time on it. Don't get stuck into the now we've got it, we have to use it kind of syndrome. And finally, remember that the simplest solution may not always be the best. I always think about the guy who wants to fix his car with a hammer and a vice grips. It just sometimes it isn't going to fly. I'm going to talk a little bit about open source slash quote free tools. I'm sure you've all heard open source doesn't equal free. However, when you have budget constraints, it sometimes works out that way. I'm sure many of you have proprietary tools, and you might even prefer those. Actually, I started with a proprietary tool and switched after about the first 6 months of use. I've listed just a brief set of tools here I'm going to introduce, but by all means, Google it. There's lots of stuff out there, just about any language, or even if you're not into programming, there's actual GUI tools out there. The obvious one that comes to mind is Rhapsody. Find one that you like, try it out. The OHF tool is the first open source tool that we really seriously started using. And actually now I think OHT is a better acronym for that set of code. It's both V2 and V3 core compliant. It does support XML in the V2 format. I haven't truthfully kept up with the OHT move in the last year, but feel free to check that out. It's a very complete and wonderful tool set. One that I've just recently gotten into is by a fellow named Mike Litherland. It's newell.org. He's just a healthcare programmer who's written this very lightweight tool set. If you are a Java shop and you want to do it in Java, but you don't want to carry around all the baggage that you necessarily get with a complete set, this is a great way to get started. I just used this kit on a recent project, web-based ELR entry project, and it just worked out great. I got interested in it because it does include the MLLP transport layer, and it has a little nifty GUI transport configuration and an HL7 browser. So you can use this right out of the box even if you don't want to use the program. There's a Perl toolkit, SourceForge, lightweight, small, easy to get into. If you're a Perl programmer, this might be the one for you. MessageMaker is something from NIST. It's basically meant to be a test harness so that you can test your V2 conformance. But it does have embedded within it most of the things you would need to create and massage HL7 messages. And then lastly, if there's any Python fanatics out there, actually one of the guys, one of my coworkers, loves Python. We don't let him use it though. But of course not. It's a great example though, if you want to roll your own, how you can really get into HL7 messaging with a very minimal tool set. So let's talk strategies a little bit here. Divide and conquer is what it's really all about. Take your big problem, start busting it down. Look for patterns in your messages. You'll see that a given LIS will repeat the same kind of mistake over and over again. Once you find that, you can turn that into something that works for you. 90% of your problems are going to be easy. So do them first. And then the big ones, the really tough ones, hey, let them go. If you can't get them, let them go. At least you're getting something that's 90, 95% better than what you started with. And then finally, remember, you're not the only one that's doing this, and it's not the first time. So ask around. There's a very good chance someone else has solved your problem already. Second strategy is to play by the rules. This one is really important. Spend some time, formalize some rules that describe the nature of the transforms that you're trying to perform. Rules can be directly implemented by your geeks, guys like me. I love it when our program people can come to me and give me something in plain English that I can translate directly into code. Use simple, natural language to do this. Make it so that anyone in your organization can understand it if they have any inkling at all of what you're trying to do. And lastly, rules can become de facto documentation of what transforms you're doing and exactly why you're doing them, which is also important. And that saves you some work. So let's talk about some techniques. I'm really adverse to acronyms and fancy terminology, and so I like to think of these things the way we'd talk about them back in Oskaloosa, Iowa, where I grew up. The first one I call the old switcheroo. This is the simplest one. This is where you have an HL7 data element, and basically you want to change it from one thing to another. Table-driven approaches work great for a lot of these things. You can just match an item in one table to an item in another table. Pattern matching is real similar to that, but it gets a little fancier because you can use things like regular expressions, wildcards to match patterns for picking the value that you really want. And then reformatting is a big one. They'll send you a telephone number, it looks one way, and you really want it to look another way. So here's an example of the old switcheroo. This is really apparently contrived, but you'd be surprised how many messages you'll run across or things within your messages that are really not all that unlike this. Let's try the next technique I call a shell game, and really this is kind of like the old switcheroo, only we're moving things around within our message. It can be moving data from one element to another, splitting elements, combining elements. Sometimes you find we even have to morph the segments, turn one segment into another one. Here's an example of the shell game. And notice I've put some rules in here. And if you look at these rules, the way I've written them, there's plain English, and then in parentheses, there's things that the programmers can pick up on. So the programmer can take, he goes, oh, OBX-2, I can identify exactly where my segment in my code using that kind of nomenclature. And yet, someone who's not a programmer can read this and hopefully understand what's going on here. So here's one where we actually morphed a segment. Technique three, I call use it or lose it. And this poor lady, she's probably grieving over her lost husband. you can use this when data isn't needed or is incorrect or is not used, where you need to discard an element. Individual data within the segment, sometimes you need to get rid of an entire segment or in some cases a whole message. I use this for messages that I just simply cannot transform. And earlier I talked about be ready to punt on the hard stuff. This is one place where I would punt. If a message comes through and it's so fouled up that I simply cannot put it into a form that can be accepted, I'll just simply discard it. I'll probably note that so that someone can go back and maybe hand edit that message to make it acceptable. But in your automated transforms, you need to be able to do something along those lines. So here's a use it or lose it example. Don't report numeric results for ampicillin. So perhaps we get two OBX records for ampicillin. One is a numeric type SN, and one is, say, a textual, which would be perhaps sensitive. And maybe sensitive is the only thing you really want the downstream system to see. Technique four, I call it 23 skidoo. Now we're getting kind of fancy, and this is getting a little bit closer to what you're going to see in real life. These are transforms for arbitrary problems. Quite often, the transform is state dependent. It's going to depend on stuff that you've seen before or stuff that you may see after. It can be context sensitive. The thing that you need to change may depend on something else existing within that segment. It can affect multiple segments. The main thing to remember here is, more often than not, you can take these kind of transforms and break them down into smaller, simpler steps. Those steps may have to occur in a specific pattern, but it makes it easier to understand what you're trying to do. Here's an example of the 23 skidoo. So we have a test result that's textual for ampicillin, and the previous result was numeric for it. And we decided we really didn't want two segments for ampicillin, but we wanted all the information there. And we want it to be a string data. So we've taken the two OBX segments and combined them into a single segment. The last technique I call played against SAM, which is a misquote as any Casablanca fans out there will know. Some transforms are common to any kind of message within the message type that you're processing. It's important to figure out what kind of transforms those are, because you can defer even worrying about those until you've got all the hard stuff done, and then do them at the end. And because they are common, you write them once and you're finished. Now, some examples of those are message syntax checking. One thing I did early on with our ORU processing was I wrote in a syntax checker for the basic syntax of the message to make sure the segments followed in the order we expected them, that all the segments that we needed were there, that the segments that we didn't need got either filtered out or identified as errant. A fancier one is fixing up the sub-ID with an apparent-child OBR linkage. This might happen because the previous parent OBX record had its sub-ID changed because a sibling of it was deleted, for example. And then the last two were fairly easy ones, but they're easy because you do them at the end. The OBX set ID, if you're familiar with the HL7, is the first field that is basically a sequence within the message. Same thing with the sub IDs and the NTE. So wrapping up here, start out by developing your rules. Work with your technical staff, and this is something I didn't touch on earlier, but it's super important. Get together, partner up, and I'm speaking now from the IT perspective. If your technical staff, or if your, if your program staff, partner up with your IT people. The program staff have knowledge about the nature of the data and what they really want the content of that message to be. The technical staff are the ones that can make it happen. You need to get together. It's important that both cooperate and have a close relationship that guarantees that you're going to get the right thing and you're going to get early on in the game. Pick your tools, get comfortable with them, get the easy stuff done first. Know that you can build solve these complex problems by building upon smaller, simpler steps. Try to avoid the state-sensitive stuff as you can. It's not always possible. And lastly, and this is also important, create testing data and strategies for each transform, whether they're big or small. Because what's going to happen is this. You're going to start out and you're going to do 3 or 4 or 5 transforms. And everything's going to be working really smooth. And then you're going to come up with a new transform that needs to be added. And you're going to add that in, and it's going to have some kind of side effect because of state issues. If you have good testing strategies in place, you'll discover that immediately. You won't have to wait until 4 weeks into production and that particular message comes along that breaks. due to those kind of problems. And that concludes. So I also want to thank Mary, by the way, for doing such a great introduction on HL7 structures coming in. That's one of the things my boss said, are these people going to know what HL7 looks like? I said, oh, yeah, sure, they'll know.
Thank you. Questions for Tom? So I have one quick question for you. So a lot of us within HL7 use XML Spine, the Altova suite of tools, and they have a, if you've already got the enterprise license, there's a package in there called MapForce. Have you used MapForce?
No, I have not.
Yeah, so it lets you put some of those mapping rules in that says, if this, then change it to that very easily. And even if you don't have the suite, it's a pretty cheap tool. It's not open source, but it's cheap.
The mapping rules are by far the easiest to implement, regardless of what kit you're using.
And then it actually writes your Java code or your .NET code in the background. So,
what trading partners does your lab exchange HL7
use? Oh, yeah, and I actually had intended to give a little more background on how we got into this. The Wisconsin Lab of Hygiene serves as the ELR messaging hub for the state. So we're kind of a funnel. We have cooperative arrangements with, I don't know, a dozen labs or so now throughout the state, both public and private reference laboratories and hospitals. We basically offer them help in setting up transport. So we were using FinMS, so we set up transport for them. And then we accept their messages in pretty much whatever format they'll give them to us. Then we take that and we perform the necessary transforms to put it into a common format that our Wisconsin disease surveillance system will accept. So that's kind of the background on how we got into all this. We do also do some orders processing, but the vast majority of it is ELR. Yes, sir. Resource-wise, I'm basically the ELR technical person, and it's not the only thing I do, but it's probably right now about 60 or 70% of my job. And then we also have on our program staff, Mary Wettig, who's sitting right over here, and ELR is probably 70 or 80% of your job, right? So Mary is the liaison contact with the laboratories, and then we work together to work through the technical issues.
Other questions?
I'm just curious about your sustainability model. Do you provide that as a service, or do you charge for that, or how do you finance your infrastructure to do this?
Well, basically, we work at the behest of our Department of Public Health. So there is grant money available and program money available through them. And of course, the Lab of Hygiene itself is about 80% funded through fee for service. We provide services to the general public in the environmental area. We do a lot of water testing, drinking water testing, and that sort of thing. And then, of course, on the clinical side, we provide prenatal screening. Our CDD division, Mary, maybe you can.
Communicable disease. You know, we do a lot of the communicable disease testing, though, is not fee-for-service. It's more public health.
But the basic model for the lab is a fee-for-service model. I think it's less than 20% of our revenue comes from directly from state taxes. So.
Thank you. The data that you receive and you work on translate, is it only reportables, or do you get the whole data feed from the laboratory and then you pick out the reportables?
It depends on the laboratory. We definitely do some filtering. For example, we do not send HIV data to our disease surveillance system. We filter that out, and we have a separate reporting system for that. And that's one of the transforms we perform, is that filtering. So, And I'll also note that the transforms, by and large, have been integrated with FinMS. So we have, and that's a speech I gave last year, but we've basically extended the FinMS message handler to perform the transforms as part of its reception protocols. So it's a like a one-step deal. It's real short and clean and compact from that standpoint.
Do you do any validation process with the labs whose data you're handling that the way you transform it and represent it to public health, in fact, is an accurate representation of what they sent you?
Yes, we do. I work on that end of it. So after transforms, we always give them like what a WES report would look like, mm-hmm. and what we always let them know what we're transforming.
Part of the self-documentation that results from writing these rules is what aids us in doing that, of course. And then, as Mary said, we're constantly monitoring the thing that the user sees, which is this report, this obtainable through the disease surveillance system. So,
thank you very much. I would like to thank our entire panel.